From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In May of 2005, as a way of celebrating the 25th wedding anniversary, the nature writer Gary Ferguson and his wife Jane went canoeing on the Kopka River in a wilderness region of Ontario, Canada. They were caught up in the rapids, the canoe capsized, he broke his leg, Jane drowned. And Ferguson says one of the things they shared was this deep passion for the wild, but after the accident, he says much of that passion went with Jane. Over time, he says he realized that coming back to life would require a kind of reassembly. And so he wrote a book about that process. And he found redemption in a request that Jane had made. She wanted her ashes scattered in her five favorite wilderness areas. Today in the program, we're talking with Gary Ferguson. His book is called The Carry Home. After the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2005, the nature writer Gary Ferguson and his wife Jane were on the Kopka River in Canada when their canoe overturned in a nasty section of water. He was dragged under a few times, thrown against the rocks. He broke his leg. Jane died. And one of the things he and Jane had shared, probably the thing they felt most strongly about, was wilderness, wild country. But after the accident, Ferguson says he lost his passion for a time, which meant losing a kind of trust, and he says he wasn't sure if he'd ever get it back. But his redemption came in a request that Jane had made years before. She told him that when she died, she wanted her ashes spread in her five favorite wilderness areas. So when he could muster the energy, he went on five journeys, and he wrote about it in a book. At first, he says those journeys broke his heart, but they also helped him piece it together again. Gary Ferguson is in Utah this week, so today in the program, he's joining us to talk about the lessons he learned in his book. It's called The Carry Home. Ferguson is the author of 25 books on science and nature, including Land on Fire. We spoke with him about that not so long ago. He's in Utah as a guest of Weber Pathways. This is a group focused on trails and open spaces in Weber County. He's joining us today from the campus of Weber State University in Ogden. And Gary Ferguson, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. A great pleasure to be with you as well.
I wanted to begin, but let me ask you this first. Is it still difficult to talk about the accident and the certain moments of that?
Well, it has an emotional content, as you can imagine, Doug. But to be honest, I think that the things I learned from, as you put it, the gift of Jane's last request to scatter her ashes are so helpful and so profound that in some ways I'm eager to talk to people about it. Because, you know, even if we don't all go through this kind of tragedy, we all do go through transitions and changes in our lives. And I think some of what I learned by going back to the wilderness at Jane's request is applicable to all sorts of transitions that we face, from the last child leaving home to marriage and divorce to aging. And so I'm very happy to talk about it, actually.
How did she tell you? I was wondering, was it like a formal pronouncement, like, I've been really working this out, Gary, or was it kind of spur of the moment? You know, I've kind of been thinking about it. There are these five places. How did she tell you?
Well, that's really one of the more remarkable things about this, Doug. We had discussed where each of us, you know, might want to have our ashes scattered probably 12 years prior to this accident, and had not talked about it again. And then just 2 days before she died, out of the blue, as we were rolling down the highway in our wonderful 79 Chevy van we converted and put 350,000 miles on together, she just turned to me and said, "Now, you know, if anything ever happens to me, where I want my ashes scattered," and I was you know, sort of surprised and recounted the list as I understood it, and she confirmed it. So, you know, I don't think too much about it, but there was you could wonder if there was some sort of prescience. The timing was really extraordinary.
I have to say there were other moments of prescience that made me, that raised questions for me what you made of them. For example, you found some letters from Jane to your mother. This was a few months after the accident. And in one, this was from 1982, she wrote this. She wrote, "One of my biggest fears is to drown in murky water in a place where you can't see the bottom." Now, in the book, you say that reading that, finding that letter, slammed the breath right out of you, which I get. But what did you make of that? I mean, there's some kind of weird cosmic coincidence going on. In some ways, it seems kind of cruel, but maybe there's some other thing that you take from that.
Yeah, it is difficult. And of course, we each as individuals will assign our own meanings to events and build our own stories from them. And that was, by the way, exactly the condition of the water. It was up north in Canada, as you suggested, and very tannin rich. So it was murky tea colored water, which is one reason why it took the search and rescue teams 3 full days to actually locate her body, because there was no visual ability to see it. They ended up using a dog trained to smell scent coming from under the water. But to read that, you know, I don't need to fix an absolute theology or anything to it, but I do wonder in some ways, and if you look at indigenous cultures, a lot of them refer to these sorts of insights into how our own lives will go, or how the lives of our loved ones will go, as very matter of fact and matter of course. I think in another place, this sort of thing would be rather taken in stride. It's in some ways caused me to wonder how much of our own level of intuition or predilection toward this and that in our lives has been just buried because we're not quiet enough, long enough to be in that state of mind. And also we don't have elders suggesting that those are skills or abilities or intuitions that we can cultivate in our life. So maybe Jane had access to that for whatever reason, and most of us just, if something like that comes to mind, we quickly dismiss it because it just isn't logical and it isn't scientific.
There's this moment that you write about. You and Jane were in the Canadian Arctic in this massive tundra region called the Barren Lands. And you had come across these stacks of rocks that were erected by I guess, ancient indigenous people.
Yes. And
I want you to tell the story because I found it really interesting, especially the kind of the insight that Jane gets from this, how she sees how she sees what it would be like to live a life where you're just on that edge between life and death. And she's contemplating what life was like. I guess you both were, for the Inuit or the people, the indigenous people of that time. Would you tell this story?
Sure. You know, I think it's so common for most all of us living in the modern world, at least in this culture, to just be close to horrified to think how challenging life might have been, especially living in the far north in the Barren Lands thousands of years ago, where life and death were on such a very thin knife edge, where there really weren't chances to make mistakes without often dire consequences. And so I was coming sort of from that space of how terribly difficult life must have been. And I was wondering aloud with Jane whether or not the indigenous people of those days, you know, worried about that, whether that was part of their consciousness about how tough things were. Because I think in relation to how I live my life, if I had that level of uncertainty and potential disaster, I might get caught up in thinking about it and therefore take some of the life out of the present moment. And she actually saw what I have come to believe is probably the more accurate perception, and that's that living outdoors like that, moment to moment, making the best decision you can as conditions arise, creates a kind of present moment intensity of both beauty, really intense beauty, mm-hmm. and gratitude, that there probably isn't a lot of room in one's mind and heart for worrying about what might happen. So in fact, there could be a much deeper level of satisfaction for those who really must stay focused. And I'll have to say, one of the reasons I believe that she was right is because when I did start to go back to the five wilderness areas to scatter her ashes, when I did the first couple especially, I was still very much racked in the early stages of grief. Yeah. But one of the things that being out in the natural world does, I think for most all of us, is it opens up a present moment mentality. It allows what the Greeks referred to as a definition of beauty, and that was to be of one's hour. Mm. So even though I was awfully sad and devastated, and you'd think, well, that's the last hour you would want to be in, by being in nature, somehow there was an ability to accommodate that grief, accommodate that loss, mm. be in the present and walk through grief, as opposed to trying to distract myself from it or to medicate myself against it, which is what, to be honest, a couple doctor friends suggested I should do.
You write about longing for that that part of the world where, this is how you put it in the book, where you're never expected to be anything but what you were, and you're never encouraged to ask for anything that you didn't already have. Like just the present moment, here's where I am, this is who I am, this is where I am, and just take it for that.
Yes, I love that. Thanks for bringing that up, and I do think that that's a critical part of elder culture that we sometimes are missing in modern America, and that is that notion that reassuring those of us who are younger and less experienced that we do, in fact, have everything we need, that life will not give us anything that we don't have the skills and the heart and the emotional maturity, basically, to handle, especially if you've got that sort of community around you to help guide you through times like this. So, yes, that's an extremely important point, and I think about it almost every week, even now.
Did Jane have that calm, that sense about her always? Or did she? I guess she came to it, because one of the things you write about is she had this deep sense of trying to be perfect early on, and it seems that part of her evolution, just as maybe nature did this to her, was to come to terms with the idea that this is just what it is.
Yes, absolutely. She did have an experience when she was young, let's say from 8 or 9 through her mid-teens, of trying to be the perfect daughter for a very successful farmer in a small southern Indiana town where sort of all eyes are on you and lots of expectations laid on you as far as what it means to be this man's daughter. And she wanted to please him. He was a good man, but she really had not much sense of herself. And it led to, as these things can do, to a very severe eating disorder. Mm-hmm. She actually tried to kill herself with an overdose of sleeping pills that landed her in the hospital. And shortly thereafter, a cousin told her about Outward Bound. And so at 17, she came to southern Utah, to the Capitol Reef area, mm-hmm. and did a very long 4-week Outward Bound experience that really opened her up as well to the very kinds of lessons that nature isn't so much prone to teach, but prone to allow us a setting by which we can realize the fundamental truth of those lessons, and one of which was for her, you're okay just as you are, and that diversity and uniqueness is a strength in nature. That's how the natural world remains so resilient, is because of its diversity and resilience. She took those lessons on and became an outdoor educator and tried to teach other young people that kind of sensibility for the rest of her life.
It seems like that idea of her teaching, which you describe as a nearly perfect fit for her, Like not all of us find the exact thing we're supposed to do, but it seems like you think that teaching young people, getting them out in nature, was that thing for Jane. And that's kind of a theme in the book in some ways, and maybe in her life, because you came to Utah in the mid-90s doing, and you wrote about this, doing research on the effects of wilderness therapy on young
yes.
people. I mean, it's kind of a theme.
Yes, it really is. And in her case, she was working with young people, and she was doing what Rachel Carson, the great scientist who wrote Silent Spring, said was so necessary, and that's just simply instilling a sense of wonder yeah. in children, and that they will have their own path revealed if we can light the fire of wonder. And the way to do that, Rachel Carson thought, and Jane agreed, was to put them in a natural setting, and inevitably it happened over and over and over again. I was working in Utah, writing Shouting at the Sky, focused on kids who had sort of lost their way and lost their identity and lost the sense that, much as Jane had done, that they were okay. They were racked with drug addictions, and they came into a wilderness therapy program after trying many, many other interventions, 28-day lockdown rehab, and all of them not working. And this was sort of a last resort. And that experience, spending 7 to 8 weeks out in the wilderness, had phenomenal effect to the point where they were getting results as far as drug addiction, and are to this day, that were 3 times better than the 28-day standard lockdown rehab that most of us are used to. So I was astonished. You know, it's one thing to put somebody in nature who wants to be there. You're not surprised that they come away giddy and gleeful. These were kids I was working with who had, if you could ask them to make a list of the places they most didn't want to be, the natural world would be probably number one. They came from urban areas, and they were mall kids, and they didn't want to be out living in backpacks for 8 weeks. But to see that kind of profound change in power and empowerment coming out of the natural world for them when they didn't want to be there at first, they were in tears when it came time to leave, mm-hmm. that was a profound a lesson for me.
Jane writes about how she was instructing these abused girls, taking them to nature and learning how the natural world had no intentions and that things were just as they were. I mean, again, going back to that idea, there's a story I want you to read from the book, if you would. I just find it a remarkable moment, and it shows, I don't know, to me it gave me a sense of just how calm she could be in nature. Do you need to set this up, or should we just have you read it and talk about it?
Well, let me read it, and then maybe we can talk about it, Doug.
It's great.
One night, Jane and I were bedded down on the east side of Rampart Pass, the third of 6 nights out, walking from Togedy Pass to Cody, Wyoming, in the thick of the grizzly-rich southern reaches of the Absaroka Range. Dawn was just breaking when suddenly I bolted awake to the one sound you never want to hear outside your tent, something close to a grunting pig, which I wished with every fiber of my being was in fact a grunting pig. Carefully peeking out the screen door, I spotted a big male grizzly not 6 feet away, ripping apart dead logs and snapping up ants and grubs, groaning and mumbling to himself in what seemed a coarse imitation of a good purr. Jane was still asleep, so I gently woke her. With my face close to hers, I put my index finger against my lips, signaling the need for quiet. She rolled over in her bag toward the screen door, spotted the bear, then after watching him for a couple of minutes, turned back to face the ceiling of the tent. By now, I was totally shot through with adrenaline, eyes wide, my right hand tightly clutched around a can of bear spray. Time was going very, very slowly. After another 10 minutes, my whole body buzzing, I looked over to check on Jane to see how she was handling the stress. Fast asleep. After what seemed an excruciatingly long time, the bear finally moseyed off. Slowly but surely, I settled down, started breathing normally again. Jane woke up a little while after that, said she was hungry for oatmeal. So that was part of a 500-mile hike. I and Jane joined me on quite a bit of it, did around Greater Yellowstone for a book called Walking Down the Wild, and that was one of the more exciting and, to me, stressful grizzly encounters. But you do point to Jane's ability to relax. I think a couple things were going on. She told me later that, well, there's really no sense being shot through with fear and adrenaline, since many animals actually can sense that. And you were there. You were keeping an eye on him. And so, you know, I felt like I could just relax and go to sleep. So I guess I was the designated worrier there.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. But, you know, she did also, I think, have, not in a stupid or naive way, a certain sense that, and had been in Yellowstone so often, close to wildlife, that she was good at assessing the risk or danger level by virtue of what she could see an animal doing, whether the hair was standing up on the back of the neck, the sound of a bear makes, the snapping of jaws that an agitated bear makes. So she was well aware that this bear was in sort of a blissful, happy state of mind, and somehow that was enough for her to relax. I was more prone to have that nagging thought in my mind that, yes, I see all those signs, but what if?
Gary Ferguson is with us. His book is called The Carry Home, Lessons from the American Wilderness. He is in Utah as a guest of Weber Pathways. This is a nonprofit focused on trails and open spaces in Weber County. Tomorrow night at 5:30, he's speaking at their annual author dinner in Ogden. You have to get tickets in advance, but you can get them by calling 801-393-2304. Just visit us online if you want the number as well, radiowest.org, for more information. We'll take a break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the nature writer Gary Ferguson, who wrote a deeply personal book a few years ago where he shares his story of rediscovering life after tragedy. He was canoeing with his wife in 2005 when they capsized. She died years before she had told him that when the time came, she wanted her ashes spread across the five wild places she loved. His book, The Carry Home, is about those five journeys. Gary Ferguson is in Utah. He is a guest of Weber Pathways. It's a group that's having a dinner tomorrow night. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later on the program. He's joining us today. So once things settled down, I guess, after the accident, Gary Ferguson, you know, once, as you put it, the neighbors are no longer bringing in covered dishes, and once you have a little bit of time for your leg to heal, sometime in the early fall, you pack up the van and you drive. And the question is, to where? How did you know where you wanted to go? You mentioned Jane never had been really specific about which place you go first. But you also say that it may not have mattered to her, but it did matter to you. Explain where you decided to go.
Well, I decided to go, of the five places, to Stanley, Idaho, to the Sawtooth National Recreation Area, where Jane and I first got to know each other way back in 1979 and were married in a meadow of camas lilies in 1980. That was our beginning, and so perhaps in some ways I thought that the beginning of this final goodbye should start there as well. You know, that there was, in the wake of this tragedy, and I believe this is a bit of a gift of grief, as odd as that may sound, that if you stick with it and if you can stay present, there is an ability to intuit the rightness of the next move. Now, not that you don't wake up every morning and have a knot in the pit of your stomach and weep into your coffee cup routinely, but by being disconnected and disengaged from the more trivial concerns of the world, it does offer a kind of clarity that was astonishing to me. So when I had that notion about going to the Sawtooths first as well as every other notion, how I put the other journeys together, there was a surety that is rarely open to me in my daily life. And I think that was because of what grief tends to do to our ability to focus and to intuit what's best for us as far as the next step.
I think that's one of the things I learned from the book was that what this does to your focus, what this does to your sense of mindfulness and being aware. And it seems like that the kind of the restructuring of your mindset was trying to put aside those distractions and come to that focus again.
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, you mentioned earlier my work with the at-risk teens in southern Utah. They, and I mentioned this in the book, they suddenly became my mentors. They became my teachers in the wake of Jane dying. Because I had watched many young 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds who had been suicidal, who had heroin addictions, who had sexual abuse and physical abuse issues, who really had had their lives shredded, come to the wilderness and put those lives back together again. I watched it over and over and over again. And so when it came time for me to put my own life back together again, even though the circumstances were different, I drew deeply and frequently on what I saw those kids come to realize, and they were a tremendous, tremendous resource for me.
In the Sawtooth Mountains, this was where you first scattered Jane's ashes, and you had never done it before, you mentioned. And you say, beyond the sadness of the moment, you were also frightened. What do you mean?
Well, there is in that moment, or was for me, I'm sure all of us would have different unfoldings, there was a finality to that act, to see the ashes drift off in the wind, to hear the little tiny chips of bone that are part of an urn of ashes when a human being is created, hit the waters of Alpine Lake and sift down and come to rest against the light-colored stones. Those are images that in that moment were provoking to in me again a sense of this is truly the end. It takes the sort of dream or nightmare state of a loved one's death and puts it in very, very beautiful but stark terms. There is no coming back. The person is not going to show up again. This is not a dream. And so that part of it was frightening. The comforting part of it was, and Jane herself was a big proponent of this, as have been many of my elder friends, is that by scattering, we also open up a person to become a part of the web of life again, you know, to the extent that these organic compounds that Jane had been reduced to through cremation will show up in the wing of an osprey or in the fin of a cutthroat trout, and they will, as all of us will, become part of an unending cycle. And in that, it's not a conscious immortality, but it is a kind of immortality that, odd as it may sound, does bring a sort of reassurance to it.
Read this section of the book, if you would, for us.
And yet every now and then I broke free, climbing above the sadness and the fear to become ennobled by the 500-mile drive, by this walk into the high mountains, supremely honored that it was I who'd been chosen to carry out this precious woman's last request. It was in one of those times, with that particular feeling on the rise, that I slipped into the jar a silver serving spoon from my late mother's one treasure, a table setting given her on the day of her wedding by her aunt, who finally agreed to raise her when she was orphaned at 13, and stepped to the very edge of the lake. Then it began. The sight of a fine mist of ash floating in slow motion down the shore, across the fireweed, and finally brushing the cold cheek of the lake. Also, the faint sounds of a patter of tiny bone chips hitting the water and fluttering through the shallows, shards of oyster white disappearing at last against an embroidery of granite stones. The sun was a gift warm on my face, and yet there was an old familiar sadness too, knowing the winds of October were on their way, soon to churn the waters of the lake, soon to fasten the water with a layer of ice that would last all the way to the following June.
There is there's another theme in the book that I detected about this cycle that comes up again. It seems to recede for a time, but then it emerges again. And you write about it in the context of you and Jane setting out in that Chevy van you mentioned. You say it was a time early on when millions of other Americans were falling in love with nature too. They were young, like you were. And about every 40 or 50 years or so, it seems like you say there's this drive for nature that takes hold. And I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, it's you write about it, how far back it goes in the 1700s. Would you talk a little bit about this kind of cycle that you've detected?
It's really fascinating, and many books ago, lost in the stacks of Beneke Library at Yale University is when I first began to realize this cycle you refer to. In the mid-1700s, we've got these pundits talking about how nature, wild nature, is the great equalizer, meaning that it doesn't matter how much blue is in your blood or money in your pocket when you go into the natural world, we're all equal. It hands out its blessings and its consequences equally. And this becoming then 50 years later, very entrenched as far as how we saw ourselves as a young country, to the point where in the early 1800s, even among theologians, conservative and progressive alike, the primary debate in 1805-6-7 is nature the hand and voice of God, or is nature God himself? Mm. And then we, in the mid-1800s, have Emerson, and then Thoreau, and the early 1900s, what Century Magazine called a cult, and the word cult had a little different meaning back then, but a movement unlike any the world has ever seen, where the Boy Scout handbook outsells every book in America except the Bible, and naturalists are rock stars. Mm-hmm. Then we fast forward 50 years more, we've got the 1960s and 70s where Jane and I came online, and so much of the baby boom environmental movement, which would suggest we are now in a position to have another era of this kind of rediscovery. And so I'm anxious to see how it unfolds. Mm-hmm. We do have this deep in our bones, this heritage and this inclination to want to be in the natural world. And here in Utah, a lot of discussion is happening around things like bear's ears. Mm-hmm. and those kinds of struggles. And I do think it's bringing forward in many people, in many of us, the deep sense that this natural resource is not just an economic opportunity. This is a spiritual and even a patriotic, I would argue, opportunity. And to have grown up and to matured in an era where that was the cultural backdrop, like Jane and I did, it was a profound blessing. Mm. And I do hope the environmental movement rebounds, but this time more diverse and this time more inclusive than it was in the 60s and 70s, when it was a little bit more driven by the intellect of mostly white men. I think we need a lot more diversity. Just as nature itself gains strength and resilience through diversity, this movement back to the natural world and honoring it needs that diversity too.
You feel hopeful about that?
On some days, I do. And in fact, honestly, most days, Doug, I do feel hopeful. I see, against what can be troubling headlines going on with political leadership in general, a rising of all kinds of people into positions of empowerment, into positions of responsibility to make this culture and this world a better place. It's a daunting task, and in some ways when it comes to things like climate change, I almost wonder if we need to go through a kind of grief journey, much as I did through my experience of grieving Jane, to just come to terms and to reconcile the things we've done wrong and the ways we've harmed the earth, but then really have the maturity to move on. Where do we go from here? And that's what I'm increasingly optimistic about, that we will rise to the occasion and become better stewards to this planet.
It seems like the one, I don't know, maybe I'm overthinking this, but it seems like the one thing that might be different from those other cycles, although there's always distractions, I guess, in every generation, and maybe this is me sounding like an old Luddite or something like that, but I do wonder if you think that the competition of screens and the information era is going to be the one thing that might make it more complicated for this new generation emerging to discover the wilderness to maybe be a little too distracted. I'm just wondering if you worry about that at all.
Yes, you've absolutely nailed my primary concern about what could be a barrier against this kind of set of gifts and realization and again, self-empowerment that I've talked about with you this past hour. I do think that we can have these technologies. There's nothing inherently wrong with them. But to be able to put them down a little bit, a few times a week, and go out and simply be present in the natural world or around any sort of inspiring, beautiful condition, be it art or music or whatever, is essential, because that sort of distraction that the little screens bring in is really guarding against us gaining access to the most powerful aspects of the natural world. You know, I often think of Einstein, who went to what became known as the Institute Woods, where he was teaching at Princeton and created just for him. And when he was stuck on a problem, he would walk out into the woods by himself, no distractions, and he would purposely try to imagine the various systems operating under his feet and in the trees, and knowing that he was going to be blown away by his inability and incapacity to imagine. It was too complex. We can't even do it today. And in that overwhelming, focused, overwhelming state, he would often have creative breakthroughs that would allow him to go back and do what magic he did with physics and math. That takes a kind of opening up to the presence of what's around us, and that does mean putting down our little screens, if only for a little while. So I do hope we can see that we deserve that sort of self-care.
It's Gary Ferguson. We're talking about, well, among other things, his book, The Carry Home, Lessons from the American Wilderness. Gary is here as a guest of Weber Pathways. He's going to be speaking at their annual author dinner in Ogden tomorrow night. It's at 5:30. You have to get tickets in advance, but you can get them by calling 801-393-2304. If you didn't catch that number, don't worry. Go to our website, radiowest.org. All the information is there. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Bug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the nature writer Gary Ferguson, who is in Utah this week. We'll give you some details about his speech tomorrow night. He is the author of the book, The Carry Home, Lessons from the American Wilderness. You say in the book that when you were backpacking, you and Jane, that you were two people sharing a single journey. But then when you got in a canoe, you write, you danced. What did you mean?
Well, when we walk, there is a kind of a self-containment, an independent locomotion, if you will, of the body, what the person in front or behind you does with their body or adjusting their weight really doesn't affect you, so you're not aware of it. In a canoe, however, that the dance reference has to do with, I was usually in the stern and Jane was in the bow, and so Jane's task was to look ahead and see what obstructions might be ahead of us, and I, in turn, watched what she was doing with her body, knowing and interpreting that movement to be concerned with putting us on the proper path, and then I would support her with my movement. And so the canoe became the vessel that linked our movements, much like two people dancing. And it was a phenomenally satisfying way to travel. I write in the book about a couple in their 80s who we saw in northern Wyoming who had been canoeing about 50 years together. And it was just really quite like watching couples figure skating or something. I mean, just the smallest little move on one of their parts would result in the smallest little move on the other. They were efficient and they were elegant, and it was really a thing to behold, something that beautiful, working with the river, using the river for your desired end and not battling against it.
There was an instructor at a paddling school who watched you and told you both that you and Jane had great, this is how she put it, this young instructor, you had great communication. And I really liked that idea that there was something about getting it right, canoeing, that was a process of communication that seemed crucial in paddling.
Yes, that's so true. And while there were occasionally words spoken, she might turn her head and call out loudly, "Draw left," to me. It was, as I suggested earlier, really much more wordless communication. And you know, for a couple, whether it's friends or a married couple, to have that level of deep understanding of the other is really a kind of intimacy that's quite precious.
I want to ask you about the last trip you took of these journeys, trip to the Lamar Valley in Yellowstone. Did you decide that would be the last because it was, I guess, why? Why that? Why that finally?
Well, when shortly before Jane died on the Kapka River, she had ended what had really been the Valhalla of her environmental education work, and that was to work with a program called Expedition Yellowstone that the Park Service runs in Yellowstone National Park. She had done it for many, many years. It really was the apex of all that she loved, with the age group, 4th, 5th, and 6th graders who she loved, and in the place, the heart of Yellowstone National Park, that at least in the lower 48 is to her and is to me the ultimate expression of the wild. That remains to this day, by the way, the largest generally intact ecosystem in the temperate world. And so by the time I was ready to set forth on that final journey, scattering once in the Beartooth Mountains where we spent a lot of time together and then ending in the Lamar Valley of Yellowstone where she had that work, it had been a number of years since she passed away, and I had made the transition from scattering and going out into nature as a way to mourn her loss, to handle and honor the grief and the role of death in our lives, to a place where I was truly able to celebrate who she was, who she was in this life and what she left in this life and what she taught others. And so this was more of a celebratory journey, if that doesn't sound too strange, the final carrying of that small pottery vase of ashes on those 120 some miles into Yellowstone. And so that's why I ended there. And it was perfect. That particular area had meant so much to her and so much to us that it was a great place to celebrate life.
You say that in that last trip in Yellowstone, you found yourself wishing that it wouldn't come to an end, but you also say that you had this strong glimpse of the life you knew that Jane would want for you. What was that glimpse?
It really was a glimpse of being alive, being engaged, learning, cultivating a sense of wonder, a sense of mystery. I write about three qualities that I learned many years ago from collecting nature myths from around the world, and how almost every culture I encountered seemed to suggest that it's critical to live well in the world to have three qualities in your life. And one of those qualities is beauty, the other is community, and the final one is mystery. And also, if those things are lacking from our lives, that's when trouble begins, and depression and neuroses and lots of other things. And so I think Jane would want me to be in touch with those very things, because she wanted me to be engaged as I spent whatever years I have remaining, but also because she really learned the power of satisfaction of those three qualities herself, not by reading stories about them, but by simply living the way she lived.
I want to ask you about the last time you spread her ashes there on that journey in the Lamar Valley. You said that you had intended that last scattering to be in one particular spot, and you and your friends had gone on this long walk, but something about it didn't seem right. So you wanted to go just a few miles further, and they indulged you, your friends. They thought, that's fine, we can do it. But what was it? What was it that didn't quite seem right? How were you figuring out the right place?
Well, I was downstream. In my thoughts, I was going to go downstream from what's called the Lamar Valley. And this would have been really downstream from where Jane spent much of her work life working with those kids. The Lamar Valley being the principal winter range for Yellowstone, the place where bison congregate and wolves and grizzly bears and the full flush of integrity that ecosystem holds expresses itself in the Lamar Valley. But it's also where a lot of people tend to be. And so I thought by going downstream, I would be able to have a little bit more quiet and that would be appropriate for the kind of reverence I wanted to bring to the moment. But then I decided, no, it really does need to be within eyeshot of what's called the Buffalo Ranch, which is the set of primitive log cabins that Jane worked out of all those years, and within sight of the bison that were there, and the pronghorn that were there, and all the other flush of animals that I've mentioned before. So at the last minute, we decided to continue on for another mile and a half until we reached the lower edge of the Lamar Valley with the Buffalo Ranch in sight, and make the scattering there. And we had all of the privacy and reverence we needed. So I'm glad I made that shift.
There's a Wendell Berry passage you read that you write about, which is about, you know, being at this camp he writes about in the wild, and how even though, as he put it, we had our troubles, that we were able to put them in true perspective, that the universe, as he said, is large and mostly dark, but that there's this realization that we needed to be together more than we needed to be apart. Would you say something about that? That seems to get to that community part, I guess, of those three principles.
Well, it truly does. And I meant it in relation to Jane and I specifically. Whenever we were having troubles and difficulties with each other in our marriage, we would put on a pack or load a canoe and go off into the wilds. And there was never a single time when we couldn't benefit from that and work our way through it. But the larger community thing I would say related to that is back again to the work I did with the at-risk kids, the teens in southern Utah in wilderness therapy. Those kids, as you can imagine, came in with tremendous tensions between them. They were used to coping and getting their way by not very healthy strategies, and those were all on display, as they would be, against a land that really doesn't care to entertain that sort of obsessive self-behavior or precious what-about-me notions. It demanded, and the wilderness always demands, that we be responsible for ourselves, that we be alert to what's going on, and in the case of a group setting like they were in, to work together. So this was the therapeutic part for them to a large extent. Kids who maybe some young woman would come in and just absolutely loathe who she was assigned a task with, they had to figure it out. And the consequence of them not figuring it out was, you know, not to be able to be as comfortable and as in control and as open to the wonder that was going on around them. So there was a tremendous motivation to stay warm, to eat good hot food that require that kind of cooperation. And boy, once you experience that, once you experience that community, you know, I wrote that book, I think it's been 15 years ago, and those many of those young people now in their early 30s are still in touch with one another. That's the power of that community that unfolded in that wild place.
I hope you don't mind if I ask about a story you tell early in the book about how it was not that long before the accident on the Kapka River, where two loons had swam up to the canoe. Do you mind telling that story?
Yes, I'm happy to. And I should preface it by saying I want to make sure always when I tell these stories that I'm not trying to shape an interpretation of how the world or the universe works for anyone else. I'm really trying to come from the inside out, and so what fits fine and what doesn't, that's fine too. But Jane and I were in a lake above this particular run of rapids that we could not portage, and where she ended up perishing. And in that lake, and she had a very strong affinity for loons from having worked in northern Minnesota for a while when she was in college. And loons are very cautious birds. They don't show themselves around humans very often. And suddenly the sun broke out, and this was really moments before her death. And two loons popped up right beside the boat from underneath the water, and she laid her paddle on her lap, and she turned her face to the sky, and she said, called out, "Thank you, universe." It was a so-called peak experience, as powerful and as precious to her as any she'd ever had. And those really ended up being close to her final words on this earth. And so, you know, when I got to the point where I could celebrate her life instead of just mourn her loss, it was, as you can imagine, of no little comfort, and is to this day, that she went, having shortly before stood on a stage doing what she loved, surrounded by the life and the inspiration that meant so much to her, and that got her through some of the hardest times she ever faced in her years here on Earth.
It's Gary Ferguson. His book is The Carry Home, Lessons from the American Wilderness. Tomorrow night at 5:30, he's speaking at Weber Pathways. It's their annual author dinner. It's a ticketed event, and you have to get them in advance. You can get information about it by going to our website, radiowest.org. Gary Ferguson, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure always, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.